Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 352, Bad Jews, a History. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And if the title of today's episode sounds familiar to you, well, first of all, that means you are a longtime listener of Judaism Unbound, because it was only back in episode 97, in the second year of Judaism Unbound's existence, that we had an episode entitled Bad Jews. And in that episode, we were talking to Jenna Reback, who is a writer in Hollywood and also at that time the host of a podcast called Bad Jew Weekly. And we wanted to get into this idea of, what do people mean when they say bad Jew? Is it a phrase that we should even use? Is it a phrase that maybe we should reclaim in a good way? We had that conversation back then, and in various ways, we've been having that conversation all along. Our guest today, Emily Tamkin, is the author of a new book called Bad Jews: A History of American Jewish Politics and Identities. It uses the idea of a bad Jew and the mutual accusations of bad Jewry as a way of looking at the history of the American Jewish community. So we could think of this book as putting some historical meat on the bones of this notion that the term bad Jew is used in ways that are not necessarily the most valuable. So we're excited to have that conversation with Emily Tamkin. Before we do, just a quick announcement that our latest group of UnYeshiva mini courses is launching in just a few weeks, and registration is open now. Remember, those are 3-week tastes of the UnYeshiva, and we do them periodically. And we're really excited about the classes that we're offering this coming late November, early December, between Thanksgiving and the lead up to Hanukkah. You can find out all about the classes at judaismunbound.com/classes or unyeshiva.com. We're really excited that we are, for the first time, going to have classes taught by Jewish studies professors from universities. So these are the kinds of classes that people can really only ever take if they're a student enrolled in a university, which is not most of us. And that's always been a big piece of the UnYeshiva that we've wanted to bring on board. And we're starting now. So we have a class about Kabbalah taught by Nathaniel Berman from Brown University, a class on multi-religious life called Beyond the December Dilemma with our past guest Samira Mehta from the University of Colorado. We're also super excited to have a class called The Torah of Creativity with Adina Allen from the Jewish Studio Project. And Lex will be teaching about digital Judaism. And the last thing is that I'm really excited that I'm going to be teaching a class on how to perform a Jew-ish wedding. I'm teaching that with Jen Gubitz, who's going to be our guest in a couple of weeks, from an organization called Modern Jewish Couples. And we think that's going to be a really valuable kind of class that we're also bringing on to the UnYeshiva, a new kind of class that's really about learning, but it's also about practical things. So we're going to be doing more and more of that as well. So check those out at judaismunbound.com/classes. Hundreds and hundreds of people have been taking UnYeshiva classes, and we really hope that you'll join all of us. So now let's turn to our conversation with Emily Tamkin, the author of Bad Jews, A History of American Jewish Politics and Identities. Emily Tamkin is a journalist. She is the senior editor, U.S., of The New Statesman, and previously covered foreign affairs on staff at Foreign Policy and BuzzFeed News. She is also the author of a previous book called The Influence of Soros, which explores the genesis of George Soros's influence and the conspiracy theories that surround him. Emily Tamkin, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So I want to ask, when you set out to write this book, were you setting out to write a book about bad Jews, or were you setting out to write a book about Jews and ultimately sort of discovered that you had something to say about bad Jews, or how does that process go about? What was the book that you were setting out to write?
This book has only ever been thought of in my head under the title Bad Jews, and it has never been about Jews who are bad. This came about because I wrote this book. My first book was on George Soros, and one of the things one hears from his critics is, well, actually, these attacks on him aren't anti-Semitic because look at his relationship to Israel. He doesn't go to synagogue, blah, blah, blah. And this upset me, not only because of Soros, but obviously once I sat with it, it was because of me and because how that made me feel about my own Jewish identity. And all of this was happening in the Trump years, which I think are still with us in some ways. And, you know, Trump saying that Jews, American Jews, or most American Jews don't love Israel enough. They're disloyal if they vote for Democrats. And that's like the vast majority of American Jews. And I, as a journalist, report obviously on the present day and the day-to-day, but I thought it would be useful to step back and look at the last century and look at how we have contested and debated what it means to be Jewish in America. So this is a history of American Jewishness, but it's also a history of the ways in which we have tried to claim legitimacy or authenticity and thrown the label of bad Jew at one another, or alternatively, internalized it and applied it to ourselves.
I'm just curious whether you think that with Trump, for example, with Trump's recent statements, we have reached a new phase where non-Jews somehow feel comfortable calling Jews bad Jews as opposed to bad people because they're Jewish. But, you know, that struck me that Trump would say there are good Jews and there are bad Jews, and the good Jews are the ones that support Israel and the bad Jews are the ones that don't support Israel enough, and that somehow it's appropriate for a non-Jew, not that Trump is particularly concerned about whether he's doing something appropriate or not, but is this indicative of a wider phenomenon that somehow that discourse has now become open to non-Jews to participate in?
I don't think it's new necessarily. I think you've throughout American history had people who are more comfortable with the idea, or for example, like more comfortable with the idea of the religious Jew than the secular Jew, even though, I mean, we know that this division is not actually, like, does not come naturally to Jewishness and Judaism. It's an ethnicity, it's a culture and a religion. But there are some who see the one as legible and think like, okay, I can understand that. It's these, you know, these other types that I don't like, which is anti-Semitism, I would argue, but never mind. What I think we have now is just it's become much more intense and amplified. And I also think that what we have today is not just, oh, you're a bad Jew, you're doing it wrong, but an application of disapproval of level of religious observance onto political views. So it's not just like, oh, I don't approve of, you know, how you're applying halachic interpretation to your own life. It's, oh, I don't like your views on Israel. And so even if you are halachically Jewish, I don't consider you to be real. And you see that from people who aren't Jews. And to be honest, it's given cover by, I don't want to pretend that there's an equivalence here politically right now. This is predominantly coming from people on the American right, and it's predominantly being given cover by conservative Jews.
But in reading your book, I was just, I don't know, it was this incredible experience because you were writing this history of American Judaism. I think it's fair to say that this is in a genre of books, both recent and less recent, that are just taking a crack at American Jewish history, mm-hmm. but through a specific prism, basically of how Jews and non-Jews have perceived of what the right kind of Jew and the wrong kind of Jew is. It's remarkable to read that. And what I appreciate about a turn in American Jewish history books lately, I mean, I think of books that you referenced and that we've had on the podcast, Lila Corwin Berman's book, American Jewish Philanthropic Complex, even Shaul Magid's book about Meir Kahana, a variety of Torn at the Roots, which looks at Jewish American Jewish history through the prism of civil rights and Jewish relationships to civil rights. I think there's a different effort being made than was once made about American Jewish history. There was once a set of books that tried to like do the whole thing of American mm-hmm. Jewish history. Like, let's distill 1654, when the first Jews arrived, to now into one book. And in doing that, you're automatically going to create some sense of like, oh, this, the set of things in this book are, you know, Jewish American history, and the set of things not in this book aren't, because in setting up as the framework, like, this is the goal, I don't know, you're creating a kind of gatekeeping. What mm-hmm. I like about these more recent books is like, you're not claiming that you cover all bases.
No, not at all.
And also specifically chronologically, like, you start this book much later than 1654. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to hear a little bit, because you hinted at this in your intro and in your conclusion, like the personal piece of this, like, you chose to write this book from that framework for some set of reasons. And you've hinted at it already about how you know, you were writing about Soros, but then you realize that George Soros and the way people attack him was also an attack on you. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the biggest theme of our podcast from start of it till now has been this idea of being, you know, Jewish enough or being told that you're not Jewish enough. And that phrase comes up in your book a number of times, both from you and from interviewees of you. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us, like, can you break down what is happening when people see themselves as not Jewish enough, when they're called not Jewish enough? Like, how might we sort of start to distill that dynamic? And like, how has it manifested at different points in American Jewish history?
Yeah, so I'll say that the reason I wrote this in the first person and included my own family, because I don't normally write about myself in this way, but it worked as a narrative device. But also, if this book is about challenging narratives, it felt more honest and almost more fair to the reader to show up and do that for myself and for my own family and for the stories that we've told ourselves. I write in the introduction that I really went back and forth on whether I was Jewish enough to write the book. And for all reasons, all sorts of reasons. I didn't have a bat mitzvah. I hadn't been to Israel before writing the book. I grew up quite secular. And it's funny, somebody wrote that I admitted I was an imperfect author. And actually what I write is that I was worried that I was an imperfect author and then rejected that framing because I don't really think that that is what being Jewish is. Like, it's not ticking off a certain number of boxes in the right way on a survey. Whatever being Jewish is, surely it's not. I mean, it's not that to me. And I have to say that one thing that I realized in writing this book, like, I used to call myself a bad Jew and claim it was joking. I don't do that anymore because I think what you're doing is allowing somebody else to tell you about yourself. And you're also ceding a claim to participate in debates and conversations about what does it mean to be Jewish? What is a meaningful Jewish life? What does it mean to have, you know, to engage in American Jewish politics? I asked most of my interviewees before we hung up, when I say bad Jew, what comes to mind? And far and away, the most common answer was, I think of myself. That's a little funny, but it also makes me kind of sad, to be honest, because they got this from somewhere, right? Like, this was internalized. This was how they have been treated and have been made to feel. And so I think part of what, like, you should not come into this book thinking that I'm going to give you a whole new way to think about who is bad. That is not the point of this book. The point of this book is that, or one of the points of the book, is that the idea that anybody can tell anybody else, like, hey, I'm doing it right and you're doing it wrong. It's not that it's meaningless. It has meanings, but it has so many different meanings that I'm not sure that it's, in fact, I'm sure that it's not productive. And I would rather speak about what's meaningful to me, what's morally compelling to me, what's interesting to me or to us. Like, let's actually have the debate rather than just saying, well, you're the Shonda for Degoyim, you know, like, you're the shameful one. I'm not. That is why. And I have to say that one of the nice things now that the book is out is that people have read it and said, like, in the introduction, I talk about how, you know, when my husband and I joined a synagogue, I felt kind of like a fraud filling out the paperwork. Somebody who read the book was friendly with me said, I felt the same way too. And so one of the things that I was worried about in making it personal is I don't want people to think that I'm like the protagonist of American Jewish history. You know what I mean? Like, I'm centering myself. But what I hope it will do is invite other people to have sort of a conversation with the book, with their own identity and how they themselves have felt. Like, have they had this feeling? Have they not had this feeling? It's an invitation to a conversation.
For the person who said that you admitted you're an imperfect author, that hit me viscerally. It hit me really viscerally. And I want to like talk through just like the way my body reacted to that. Because what that contention is that sort of the Jewish experience or the Jewish experience that would be a more perfect author is roughly a Jew who feels good or comfortable in Jewish spaces.
And in the status quo, right?
Right. And I've said this over and over again, and people think I'm joking or that I'm making like a sort of commentary on Jewish life, but I'm not. I'm just saying a direct thing that I think is true. The most common American Jewish experience or Jewish experience anywhere is the sense that one is not doing Jewish correctly. Mm-hmm. Like, that is more common than any other Jewish experience. I truly think that in a particular synagogue space on a particular Saturday morning, there are more people there in the room that feel like in some form or another, they might not be supposed to be there, or they don't know enough of the words, or they don't know enough of the history, or like, including sometimes, by the way, even, you know, rabbis, yeah, leaders, like this has been so thoroughly entrenched that I don't think it's silly or an overstatement or a joke to say that feeling not Jewish enough or feeling sidelined is the most common Jewish experience. And if it's the most common Jewish experience, it actually would be less perfect. It would be more of a problem for somebody who feels super comfortable in Jewish life to write this book. Yeah. That would be an unhelpful thing for all the people who would not feel seen by that author. So I kind of would love to hear more from you. Like, when that person said you're not a perfect author, like, how did that land on you and how might you respond?
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, first of all, I should say, like, nobody is owed time and attention. So I appreciate the time that everybody takes to read my book, even if they're like, well, I didn't like it. Fine. But I would also say that I think the person who said that kind of missed the point. Because the point of the book is that I'm actually not presenting myself up to other people to decide whether or not I'm perfect anymore. And I guess what I'm saying in the intro is that this is my background and what I'm bringing to it. And that has a lot of strengths and that has a lot of limitations, but it's the way that I'm exploring the story. You know, it's a history. It's not, this goes back to what you were saying earlier about, I think, this new trend in, and I want to stress here that, like, this is not an academic text. And I want to be very clear that I'm not claiming that I'm like reinventing Jewish studies. And in fact, I say in the acknowledgments that this wouldn't be possible without the work of people like academics in the space of Jewish studies who have put many more years of their lives into this than I have. And I also think, like, if a person who's more comfortable with the status quo than I am could have written this book, it just would have been a very, very different book. And it wouldn't have been the conversation that I want to have, which is why I wrote this book.
Well, I also want to put in here, just I guess maybe in this conversation, I'll play the role of the person who's coming from a more kind of Jewish background that people wouldn't be apologetic about. Mm-hmm. And I read this book and I thought there was like a lot of great information in it and a lot of great. In other words, you didn't write a less good or different book somehow from that perspective. You wrote a really great book from that perspective. And I guess what I'm curious about, given that, is actually not so much whether you should or shouldn't have written it. It's almost like, what is the experience like on the other end of it? Because a lot of the goals of this podcast and of our work more generally is to try to get more people to take the step forward and to say, yeah, I can be part of the creative class of this next version of Judaism, whether it's actually living Judaism in a new way or like thinking about Jewish history in a new way like you are. And a lot of people have obstacles towards doing that. Maybe it's that they feel like a bad Jew, but they certainly feel like they don't know enough because they didn't have a bat mitzvah or, you know, whatever set of circumstances. And I'm curious to talk to you as someone who stepped over that barrier and say, but then you didn't just start writing the book based on what you knew the day before, right? Then you go into a process of learning and interviewing. And so can you talk about the process of what we call, in a good way, chutzpah to get going on this project and how you went about it?
In terms of the writing of it, there's sort of two things that I want to say. The first is that in terms of the writing of it, even if like you're Jewish enough as you are, there's a certain amount of knowledge that you need to write a book. And not that I didn't already know a lot of the history, I did, but it meant, as I said, engaging with this field. It also meant, because I'm a journalist, going out and speaking to people. And one of the things that I'm most proud of in this book is that although there are historical figures and like prominent people in Jewish life who are interviewed, most of the people interviewed are I don't want to say just, but like they're us. You know what I mean? Like they're American Jews who are living their lives and here's what they think about it. That is one of the contributions that this book makes. The other thing I want to say to listeners who perhaps are kind of like, I don't know, is that it becomes a vicious cycle. And what I mean by that is that in writing this book, I was doing these interviews and people would talk about their synagogues. And that sounded really nice to me. And this was not something that I ever thought that I had like a right to be as a synagogue member, because we hadn't really gone regularly growing up, or because, you know, I didn't think of myself as observant in that, or as religious in that way. But we did join a synagogue and it's been really nice. Or, you know, I started learning Yiddish during the pandemic and still am, like, it's been over 2 years now and I'm still learning it. And I think I gave myself permission to engage with Jewishness more and in more different ways. And then it's like, once you do it, you're able to keep doing it and you're able to keep experimenting with what is meaningful to you, what gives comfort to you, what's challenging to you. And the other thing is, like, it's already, not to be sort of trippy about this, but it's already within you. You know what I mean? Like the thing that you are looking for, you already have. You're already Jewish. So you get to explore that however you want. And the last thing I'll say, what I came to realize is that anybody who says that I'm not Jewish enough or that I'm not Jewish, like they're not telling me anything about myself. I know who I am. They're telling me something about themselves and how they see Jewishness. And that's actually fine. Not to sound like kind of like if that's how you want to go through life, but like, no, if that's how they're going through life and that's how they're going through Jewishness, okay. But the only person you've given me any information about in this conversation is you, not me.
So I'm interested in a weird exercise, mm-hmm. which is like a classification exercise. This is probably not the most exciting of questions from your perspective, but I'm interested in like the different subgenres of people called bad Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested. There's different, like radically different things. And so like, for example, yeah. I would separate these subgenres into two general categories, one of which I think of as bad Jews that are termed that way because from somebody's perspective, they don't care enough. Mm-hmm. Like they don't care enough about Judaism. They don't go to services enough. They don't know enough. They don't, whatever. They don't do something enough. That's category one, and it's got some subgenres. Category two is let's take somebody like me, right? Like I'm a rabbi. Nobody is saying I like don't care.
Right. Yeah.
Very few people are saying that. What they're saying is, sure, you care, but you care wrong. Like you mm-hmm. care incorrectly. You care from the wrong set of perspectives. And I'm interested in
you're causing damage.
Right. You're causing damage. Like, for example, you know, Israel comes up over and over again in your book. And sometimes what people say is like, ugh, X category of Jews doesn't care about Israel enough. And right. that's sort of category one. Like they don't – Israel's not in their minds very much. Category two is, okay, this group cares about Israel-Palestine, but maybe they're calling it Israel-Palestine. Maybe they're calling it Palestine. Maybe they're doing activism right. in solidarity with Palestinians. That's all of a sudden a very different thing where it's not – oh, nobody's saying, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace or people participating in Palestinian rights movements of various sorts are – not caring. They're saying you care, but it's not the right kind of caring. So that's Israel as one example, but we could do this, you know, down the list of like political things and intermarriage and like, what are some distinctions? How might we think about the different ways that people are termed bad Jews?
So I think that's a really excellent, elegant way of putting it. I look at a different distinction in my book, which is that there's the religious, and this is maybe a different way of putting it, but there's the religious bad Jew, which is to say that you're not observant enough or you're not observant in the right way. So like, you don't keep kosher, you're a bad Jew. You're a Reform and not Orthodox, you're a bad Jew. To be clear, like I obviously don't think of any, but this is like, you're sort of not hitting, like Jewishness and Judaism are many things, but it's also a religion and you're not sort of following the steps. So there's that. And then there's also the political. You have the wrong sets of politics. I disagree with both of these, but I can sort of understand where the religious is coming from, right? Like if you really believe, like it's a faith-driven belief that you cannot eat shrimp and you see me eating shrimp, like it is orthopractic, right? So I can kind of get that. However, the thing that I think is pretty transparent here is that this idea that like, you know, like in 2021, there was this op-ed by a person who wrote that maybe these people are halakhically Jewish, but they're intermarried, which means they don't care, which means that what they say about Israel we don't need to consider that a Jewish opinion on Israel. And that's not winning an argument. That's ending an argument. You're basically saying that I can't be an interlocutor, right? So I think the sort of move from the religious onto the political or melding the two and saying like, well, you don't even count because you don't agree with me. Like, what is that? it's just so transparent. And you see it with Israel, you see it with American politics, you see it with intermarriage. Alan Dershowitz wrote this too, that listeners who have not read the book, I'm biased on this issue. My lovely husband is not Jewish. And, you know, Alan Dershowitz writing like, Jews who don't marry other Jews are obviously not serious about Jewishness. Like, Alan Dershowitz, little do you know, you're going to go and have your whole life be about being ostracized on Martha's Vineyard. I'll use this as an opportunity to say that one thing that surprised me about how people have talked about this book is that I haven't been surprised that people have talked about intermarriage because it is one of the leitmotifs of the book because intermarriage comes up again and again and again through American Jewish history. I think it's both in its own sense and also it's sort of an issue that people used as, how to put this, they used it as a, like, as a stand-in for Jewish assimilation and acculturation, and sort of debates between Jewish distinctiveness and Jewish security, both fears of the average American Jew, and also, I would argue, very consciously manipulated, sorry, by the American Jewish establishment and various institutions. So I wasn't surprised that intermarriage came up, has come up in conversations, I write about in the book. I'm a little surprised that people are still speaking about this as though it's an ongoing debate. It's not. 60% of all American Jews who got married in the last 10 years married somebody who's not Jewish. So to me, it's been quite revealing because, like, American Jews have already sort of decided. The fact that you're still having the debate, to me, speaks about this gap between the institutions who are purporting to represent an American Jewish community and a set of American Jewish communities that have already moved on.
One question that I have is whether this is a type of discourse that is unique or especially prevalent among Jews, or whether it's just like we've explored other times, like Jews are just like everybody else. And actually, it's a mistake to think that Jews are so different. And
the problem is
not that Jews call each other bad Jews. The problem is that people do this. But to the extent that it is that we are talking within the Jewish community, I mean, I'm kind of saying, like, look, if we look at it from the level of the Jewish community or Jews is a big group, then you say, well, there's lots of Jews that are doing all kinds of different things. And as long as it's over, let's say, you know, 5% are doing it, then it's hard to say that that's not a thing that Jews do, because Jews do it. And so if you say that they're not really Jewish or a bad Jew, then you can say that. But like you say, that's revealing more about you than about them. But maybe it is revealing about you that you have a sense of Judaism, that it just shouldn't be this big grab bag of lots of things. But you are arguing in favor of very distinctive Judaism. And I find myself, like, when I'm on the receiving end of the bad Jew label, I'm very aggrieved. And I feel like Judaism should be a much bigger tent than that person thinks it should be. But when I'm on the end of saying, well, I do believe that Judaism should stand for something, should stand for certain values, for certain ways of caring for the earth, let's say, and I see another community of Jews that are not interested in that understanding of Judaism, I guess my question is, what should I call them? Frustrating Jews, right? Because I don't want to call them bad Jews, but I do want to be able to make a claim that the kind of Judaism that I want to build is a good kind. I don't necessarily need to say they're bad, but I need to say that this is especially good or something like that.
Yeah, I would just say that I'm not saying that this isn't legitimate or authentic. I just think it's wrong. Those might be their Jewish values, but my Jewish values involve caring for the earth or et cetera. Listen, I don't disagree that Jewishness and Judaism should stand for something, but the reality is that we don't agree on what that thing is. So you're this people that has this, like, this mission, these core values. Okay, it's pretty clear that we don't actually agree on what those are. And I was also thinking about, you know, with respect to intermarriage, where people say, like, well, to prevent it is a check against assimilation. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've met many, like, young Jews, and I don't mean, like, this is not to disrespect anybody's Jewish marriage, but they're marrying another Jewish person does not necessarily make you, quote unquote, distinct. Or it does, but not in a, like, I still feel like I'm distinctly Jewish. You know what I mean? It's just funny to me that people think, like, well, we're just going to keep it in the household, and thus we'll be protected against the march of time. Personally, I became much more conscious about what Judaism and Jewishness meant to me after marrying somebody who wasn't, or after joining with somebody who wasn't Jewish, because I sort of had to think about it. If I want a Jewish household, what does it mean to me? So I think what I would say to people who are still in 2022 hung up on this is that, one, it's happened. It's not going to, like, I'm not going to get divorced because of it. And two, that this is an opportunity for people to explore this identity, explore this religion in a way that maybe they hadn't before. And you can be a part of that, or you cannot be a part of that. Those are your choices.
I sometimes play around with saying a certain set of statements that really confuse the hell out of people. That might sound like, Lex, you're being obnoxious, but I think that confusion is one of the most helpful human emotions, because it tends to precede understanding or realization. Like, you have to be confused about it. So I sometimes say the following, because, and I'm going to quote you, you said, just because you marry somebody who isn't Jewish, that doesn't mean you don't care about being Jewish.
Right.
You said, I might not be getting it exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
What I often will say is, just because you marry a Jew doesn't mean you don't care about being Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah.
The reason I say that sentence is because it hits people as like I misspoke. They actually can't. It's you used the word legible before. It's like not legible to them.
Right.
And I'm going to say it again, just in case listeners are in that zone. Just because you marry a Jew doesn't mean you don't care about Judaism. A set of people and organizations and movements have made that sentence hard to understand because mm-hmm. they've so thoroughly equated intermarriage with not caring that much about Judaism, such that if you say like intramarriage, marriage between Jews, is somehow a hint that you don't care about Judaism, like that doesn't even make sense. It's like, what are you talking about? But I'll tell you, like the dynamic you describe where Jews marry someone who's not Jewish and that actually sparks specifically, dafka, to use the Hebrew term, it sparks specifically an exploration of Judaism that they wouldn't have had otherwise because they're forced to ask, like, why do I do this holiday? Like my partner is asking me. So I it's not that they're like quizzing me, but I do want to have an answer to like why I'm lighting Hanukkah candles and why I feel connected to it. So I go and like Google deep dive or talk to my friends or think mm-hmm. about what that means. Like this is an understood dynamic that scholars have explored. It is not just to quote Jacob Plitman in your book, who Cards on the Table is a friend of mine. He says like the job of organizing is to make people realize that personal feelings are actually not just personal. They're political dynamics. Like I would like every intermarried Jew out there who thinks, you know, I've actually become more engaged in my Judaism because not in spite of because. Right. Of my intermarriage, I want you to know that that's not just you. And I get that it's like an aggressive thing for me to say, like, just because you marry a Jew doesn't mean you don't care about Judaism. But there's a way to do that with intermarriage. With Israel, I sometimes will say to people, just because you're a Zionist doesn't mean you hate Judaism. Like by the way, there are a lot of Zionists who hate Jews. We could talk mm-hmm. about Richard Spencer. We could. It's not rare. But that sentence, once again, has been made illegible because even those of us who disagree with it, we've decided that like that's a sentence that matters in the world to be pro-Israel, to be Zionist is to in some way or another support Judaism. Mm-hmm. And we spend our time responding to that and saying it's wrong as opposed to saying this other thing that being an anti-Zionist or a non-Zionist or whatever hyphen Zionist people happen to be is Jewish. I don't know. Like, can you help us better understand the responses to being called a bad Jew and like the discourse around
I would say two things. I think one of the things that I've explored in this book is that not to knock all American Jewish institutions, but I think for at least the last century, they have taken on a very special place, a privileged place in American Jewish life. The American Jewish community, who is you? Like when you say I speak for you, who are you talking to? And I think that's really true. And it has been for at least 100 years and it becomes truer with every passing year. But institutions and organizations exist in part to speak for some people. They have always at various moments in American Jewish history not been quite in step with many American Jews. So we should just say like this is not new. The thing that sort of makes me sad is that people that being called a bad Jew inspires you to check out, right? Like why do I need to engage with this thing that doesn't want me? Like why do I need to try to like bang down the walls? I don't need this. I can go do anything else with my time. I think even people who are like, yeah, well, it doesn't really matter because I'm totally secular. You don't have to, like, you don't have to engage with Jewishness if you don't want to, but are you only not engaging because you think it doesn't really belong to you in the same way? People sort of downplaying their own Jewish, you know, I quote a woman toward the start of the book who filled out my little form about being interviewed for it and then emailed me to make sure that she was the right kind of Jew. And I was like, if you're Jewish, yeah, like that's the point. It was because of how other Jewish people had made her feel over the course of her life, that she wasn't enough. So I think there's that. And I also think that like there's a tendency in progressive politics now to try to flip it and be like, actually, this is Judaism and that's not. And it's like, no. There are also parts of Judaism and Jewishness that I find really unsavory and disagree with, and there are interpretations that I disagree with. So I think those are sort of the two responses that I have seen. Either you check out or you're like, no, mine is the real one, which I also think like you're not going to win. I think what you put forth is much more helpful because it's sort of a reframing rather than just taking the same old frame and moving it over.
Well, it reminds me a little of what we were talking about a few weeks ago when we realized that on Yom Kippur, we had an extreme amount of downloads of Judaism Unbound.
Mm-hmm.
And the question became, how do we describe this? And one of the ways that at least I got to in my head was some people have a practice on Yom Kippur of doing nothing electronic, you know, treating it as a Orthodox type Shabbat. And some people have a practice of listening to podcasts, which right. is basically the opposite of that. In other words, the two are not reconcilable or hard to reconcile. What does a world look like in which we can say that these are both ways to practice Yom Kippur, that there's not one that's the good kind and the bad kind in either direction? And, you know, similarly with Zionism, as an example, you could say, it doesn't seem like this is what most people do say, but you could say one way to be a really good Jew is to be a Zionist because you're concerned about having a refuge for Jews in case of persecutions. And one way of being a good Jew is to be a non-Zionist because you believe that we have suffered a lot from nationalism and we don't want to have our own, right? Whatever your justifications are. But you would say, these are both ways that I can imagine being a good Jew.
Okay, so that's exactly right. And it's not, I think some people think that I'm saying that we all need to like get dinner with our political enemies and like say, yes, I have no problem with anybody on the, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying is, let's just imagine that the person taking that stance, that they are coming at this from a place that's informed by their Jewishness and their Judaism. And then we can, like, having made that assumption, we can have the conversation or not, or we can check out because it's not worth speaking to that person. But we've acknowledged that all of this is indeed Jewish, and that if it's not, neither one of us is the authority. There's no Pope.
So given that this book is a history, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the moments perhaps that struck you as you learned about them as most, almost like most open to potentially a path not taken, that there were certain moments where these could have been handled differently and maybe American Jewish history could have been more expansive in the way that you're describing. And I suppose that the reason this is really of greatest interest is because the question is, well, what would it look like if we took those forks in the road that we're going to encounter over the next decade or so and make a different choice than what we've seen Jews make in the past?
Two come to mind. The first is, what would have happened if, rather than realizing the whiteness could protect us and really arguing, including before Congress, that we should be considered white, what if American Jews had spent from earlier on, like even the 1920s, tried to push back against America's racial hierarchy? What if we had done that instead? And the second is the 1950s, when the Red Scare was targeting Jewish people, what would have happened if American Jewish institutions, instead of turning over the names of potential communist sympathizers to the authorities, had said, no, that this is, we're not going to play this. You know, this is supposed to be a land of political opportunity and pluralism, and this is anti-Semitic. I think it's actually hard for me to imagine the world we would live in today had that happened, because it was so the opposite. Like, what would have happened if Commentary hadn't published an essay calling for the execution of Ethel Rosenberg? I have a hard time imagining it.
Those are two really great examples that I want to invite you to give more detail about, just so for people who don't know much about what Commentary is, mm-hmm. just for Commentary being a conservative, lowercase c Jewish publication.
Yeah, so it's in the post-war period. It's American Jewish. It was the publication arm of the American Jewish Committee. And it was sort of, I mean, it's basically the outlet of, it, or it became the outlet of neoconservatism. But during the Rosenberg trial, as a smaller number set of American Jews said, hey, this is anti-Semitic. Basically, Lucy Davidovich published an essay saying that it would actually be, basically that it would be anti-Semitic, like not to execute Ethel Rosenberg, thus leaving her two sons an orphan. And wasn't, I think that's an extreme example. But during the McCarthy years, I think two things. One, I think American Jewish institutions were scared. But I also, you know, to be honest, I think that they sort of saw an opportunity to separate Jewishness and socialism, get rid of dissent in that way, and they took it. Because there is also this socialist tradition in American Jewishness and American Jewish thought. You know, so many of the American Jews who came over from Eastern Europe, the Workman's Circle, you have the Bund, you have this whole like lefty tradition of Yiddish. There were people who were very uncomfortable with that. But anyway, I think those two moments are basically where there was a chance to challenge U.S. authority, basically, and the ways that things have always been done in the United States, you know, the politics of the United States, the racial hierarchy of the United States. And I don't really think American Jews, for the most part, did that. I'm not talking about the civil rights movement, by the way, which we can talk about in a bit. I'm talking about like when Jewish immigration status came up for question, the arguments that American Jews put forth and saying like, no, we deserve to be treated like other white people, or after World War II. And you know what, to be sympathetic, I do understand anti-Semitism was at an all-time high during World War II, while maybe your family members overseas are being killed. Afterwards, you don't want to like start the revolution, right? Like you just want to use the GI Bill and buy a nice house and raise your kids. I do understand that. But I'm also curious as to what would have happened had American Jews at the time said, well, wait a minute, why isn't the GI Bill applicable to Black Americans?
Yeah, boy, I'm really struck by a lot of what you brought. And just I want to name that in your book and at the beginning of our podcast, just the term the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about your book is you tend to put it in quotes,
yeah,
which is a commentary on how we use this word, the Jewish community, which suggests there is one. And what's interesting and what's always interested me about that term, and I think I said this in like our first or second episode, is that that term is not the Jewish population.
Right.
And it is consciously, that's not a coincidence. It is consciously not the Jewish population, because what people want to suggest with the Jewish community is that there's a group of Jews, and they don't do this maliciously. They're not doing this with like a sneaky smile on their face, but like they are trying to suggest that like, look, there are things that people do that sort of make them roughly, you know, I don't want to say citizens, but kind of like members, citizens, somehow in Jewish life, quote unquote, the Jewish community. And people who don't do those things, we're not going to say they're not Jews, but they're Jews who aren't doing the thing. They're, you know, non-citizen, non-members of the Jewish community. And there are organizations that will say directly, like, we aren't looking to hear those people's voices as much. We are looking to be there for people involved with a certain set of Jewish institutions. And if you're Jewish and not connected to any of those, like, sure, you exist, but that's not our purpose.
Yeah.
And that distinction, I think, is so important. And you hint at it with the civil rights movement. Like, one way to talk about what Jews were or were not during the civil rights movement is to talk about the set of organizations with the acronym J in their name that stands for Jewish, and what their statements and actions and whatever were with respect to Black civil rights in this country. Another way to go about it is to look at however many million Jews were in the United States, what their voices said, what they voted for, what they didn't vote for, what they did with their actions, what they didn't do. By the way, both sides of that don't come out only positive. Like, it's really important to say that. Like, even if I want to say, you know, American Jewish institutions did some harmful things and sort of co-signed whiteness in the way you described, you know, signed on to a world in which, and by the way, it's important to say, like, even then, not all Jews were white. And there were people within the Jewish community, quote unquote, that were being marginalized by the Jewish institution's own decisions. But like, there were institutional voices. But even if we go to like the people, quote unquote, it's not as if all American Jews were down in Mississippi for Freedom Summer in 1964. There were a lot of them, for sure. But there were people in the North and the South and the East and the West who were saying, like, let's chill. Like, maybe we vote for Democrats, but like, let's be quiet. Mm-hmm. If we're too loud about this, it's going to bite us in the ass, because we've worked for, you know, they didn't say white Jewish, but they meant white Jewish inclusion in American society. And so if we're too loud for Black Americans, who we know are always going to be at the bottom of our society, and we just concede that it has to be that way, basically, which is itself a racism, right? Mm-hmm. But in public discourse, not be too loud. So I wanted to make sure we really hit on that, because I don't want to lose that in the discussions of intermarriage in Israel and stuff.
No, and also like, two things can be true, right? Like, it is true that many American Jews did participate in the civil rights movement, and it's actually, and more than two things can be true. And it's also true that like, there were rabbis down in the South who were like, can you guys not be here? This is really making things very hard for us. And it's true that there were Jews in the North who like, quote unquote, supported civil rights, but lived in their predominantly white neighborhoods and fought against affirmative action quotas because they had had this negative history with quotas. Sometimes when I talk about this, people think that I'm like, you shouldn't be proud of the civil rights movement. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it wasn't like everybody, exactly as you're saying, not everybody showed up and was wonderful. There are people who are like, well, why do we care about this? We should be caring about ourselves, about American Jews, white American Jews. There are some people who want to say like, we were always there for you, so where are you for us? And it's like, well, first of all, not all of us were always there. And second of all, it's not like we solved racism, gang. Like, there's still a lot of work to be done today. And I guess this is one thing that I hope comes across in the book, is that This book is not about anti-Semitism. There are a lot of books out right now about anti-Semitism. There is a rise in perceived anti-Semitism. However, American Jewish history, while it includes anti-Semitism, is not first and foremost about that. It is about American Jews. Two, I think if you look at the way that anti-Semitism works in this country today, it works in concert with other hatreds, right? And one of those is anti-Black racism. So if you look, for example, at this tragic, horrible, awful shooting in Buffalo earlier this year, you know, the manifesto is anti-Semitic, and then the shooter went to a grocery store in a predominantly Black neighborhood and killed Black Americans. I would really encourage American Jews who read this book to look at this not as just something that affects us. It does affect us, of course, but all of these different hatreds, they're all together in like this noxious stew. And I really do not think that focusing just on American Jews is the way, if there is a way out of it, I really do not think it's that.
To what extent is fear a predominant part of this story? That there is this trauma, whether it's trauma that's actually been experienced by the particular Jews who are making decisions or some kind of inherited trauma that drives a lot of their cautiousness. And then, you know, I think that what's happening with Abraham Joshua Heschel, for example, is then 50, 60 years later, there was one person, and there wasn't only one, but there's one person who was not fearful. And then that person is held up as a paragon of all of us. Hey, see, we weren't afraid. But actually, most people were afraid, and most people are always afraid. And I'm wondering what, if anything, you can take away from this research and from this journey that you've made to say, how can Jews get over that fear and be able to be the kind of people that stand up and make those decisions, right? Not to call for Ethel Rosenberg's execution. Probably most of the people didn't necessarily want Ethel Rosenberg to be executed, but they felt afraid to say so. And that just strikes me as something that's going on all the time.
I mean, I think you sort of just said it, which is that when you look back at history, you want to associate yourself with the person who wasn't afraid or who was afraid, but who still did the thing that they felt morally compelling. And I think when we look back at American Jewish history, there have been people who did that. Like there were people who argued and said, we need to do more to help refugees in World War II. There were people who came out and spoke out for Ethel Rosenberg. There were people who came out and marched during the civil rights movement. Like the fear is there and the shame is there. And that's part of American Jewish history, but the bravery and the moral conviction and the moral courage is also a part of American Jewish history. And that tradition is also there for us should we choose it. Not to pretend like that's the only thing we've ever done and not to say like, oh, I'm not accountable for any of this. This has nothing to do with me, but to use as an example and an inspiration and precedent for our own actions today. And it doesn't mean that you're not afraid and it doesn't mean that there aren't consequences. Like, look, other Orthodox Jews yelled at Abraham Joshua Heschel for his stance on Vietnam. And he was not silenced by that. All of this moment that we're in, like, yes, it's unique. Yes, it's awful, but it's also not new. Or it is, but it's also old. And that means that there is a precedent for some ways, I think, I hope, to navigate it with bravery and with solidarity and with moral clarity if we choose to look for it.
Well, that just brings me back to this question of what is a better discourse than good Jew and bad Jew, as you would have it. How can we say the point about Abraham Joshua Heschel is not that, hey, we Jews were so great during the civil rights movement. The point about Abraham Joshua Heschel is he stands for a number of people who did the thing that most of us didn't do. Mm-hmm. And we want to have a future where most of us do that
right
thing. What's that discourse? How can I say, and therefore the people who don't do that thing are not the kind of Jews that I want to be in business with?
I think you can say you don't want to be in business with them. Like the Orthodox Jews who told him, no, stop, like your stance on Vietnam is threatening Israel. Like that's for sure Jewish. It's just not anything that I want to have anything to do with. It's not like I'm saying like, find other words for bad. I'm just saying that this idea that like, you're a disgrace to Jews or you are not the authentic one. I just don't think that that's a productive conversation. And for me personally, I would rather say, I find Abraham Joshua Heschel to be a moral exemplar. I think that he was brave. I think that he spoke out at a time that it was difficult to do that. I hope that I would find the same lessons in Jewishness and Jewish life in Judaism. These upcoming elections, or maybe they'll have happened by the time this airs in Israel, like, you know, these far right politicians, I'm not going to tell them they're not Jewish. They clearly are. I just don't want to have anything to do with it. Maybe it's not my Jewishness, definitely is Jewish. And so us going back and forward about like, no, this is the Jewishness of the future. Like, no, they're both probably in the future. They're both going to be there. I would rather make sure that this part, that this version, that this kind that I like and I find meaningful, that exists. I can't really, I think denigrating that, denounce it, sure, but pretending that it's not Jewish or that it doesn't have roots in Judaism, like to me, that's a waste of time. And it just reinforces this framing that we are always going to lose. I'm sorry. The people who want to break from the status quo, like, are never going to win if it's just like, I'm the Jewish one, you know? Like, that's not how the status quo works.
I do feel compelled to say something. I think it's important to say, like, historically, if we look at different moments in Jewish history, like, sometimes calling people terrible Jews, which definitely happens over and over again, not just in America, sometimes it works. Sometimes it does, in fact, make certain normative Judaisms like win because people are so afraid of doing the heretical one or the bad quote unquote one that they toe the line. But there are other moments where it certainly fails.
Right.
Every year, just about when I'm giving a sermon about Kol Nidre, I start by telling Kol Nidre being the declaration on Yom Kippur that nullifies vows. I start by telling people the very first words we have historically about this famous declaration are from this really centralized rabbi whose words are, that's a stupid custom. You shouldn't do it. It's bad. Yeah. It literally, minhag shatut is the Hebrew. It means stupid, like foolish custom. That's the first thing we have heard about. And then for multiple hundreds of years, it seems that that's the main opinion of most centralized rabbis. Eventually, they lose to sort of quote unquote the people, the bad Jews, who want to say this declaration despite the fact that the centralized rabbis hate it. So sometimes calling stuff terrible actually makes people react and say, oh, we're going to do the thing you're trying to make, treif, unkosher. Putting that aside, I just wanted to get that into the conversation. The last question that I have is different. I mean, it's a gear shift to some extent, which is you said something I agree with and love, which was that you're really grateful to Jewish academia, that your book is not an academic book. You're not somebody with a PhD in Jewish studies. And you're grateful to people who are, who have written great books, and then you are citing them. I'm not really challenging you, but I hope, and I think actually this is happening. Like, I hope that the Jewish studies folks are just as grateful to you as you are to them. Some of the most important Jewish scholarship or Jewish studies scholarship is Dafka, is specifically happening by adjacent to Jewish studies people like you. I mean, when people ask me what is the best intro to Judaism book, I often send them to Sarah Hurwitz's book, which is, she was a speechwriter in the Obama administration. She's not a rabbi. She's not a scholar of Jewish studies. She wrote a great book from the perspective of just sort of a Jew in the pew that she researched well, but she didn't write from a place of expertise. I'm now going to be pointing people to your book as one of my favorite Jewish American history books, but I want to specifically lay out that, like, there's kind of a pipeline here, and it's an important pipeline, which is Jewish studies people, they're operating with a specific set of incentives and like rules. Like there's not rules in the sense of like they must do X, Y, or Z, but like their positions at universities force them to sort of write for certain publications. They're not writing for HarperCollins most of the time. That's your publisher. Like, you're writing for a big publisher. I think your book has the potential to reach a larger audience than some of those books that are written specifically for Jewish studies. And that's to your credit. That's not something to be demeaned as like, oh, you're sort of public scholarship or public stuff. That's sort of the 101 thing. No, I think that your book, a book like Sarah Hurwitz's, I think back to Robert Manukin's book, The Jewish American Paradox, all of these books are for bigger publishers by people who are not scholars of Jewish studies. And they are different. There are certain things that, like, I do think we need to go to the Jewish studies folks for. But I kind of wanted to hear from you, like, where do you see your book in the ecosystem of, on the one hand, like, Jewish studies, and on the other hand, what I'm going to call lazily Jewish learning? Like, there's people that learn in a synagogue or at a JCC. There's people who learn in a classroom or from academic books. Where does your book fit in?
Yeah, I will be honest and say that when I was writing this, I only thought of it as Jewish learning. And I've since had a couple of people say to me, like, well, as a Jewish educator, I'll use it for this, which I find extremely flattering because I did not consider it to have that kind of, like, there, you know, there's, I think there's always, academics and journalists are sometimes pit against one another. And I completely understand when academics express frustration that, you know, we take their ideas and don't necessarily credit it, which I went to great pains not to do, to credit all the research that was that took years of somebody's life, or that we come in and we oversimplify. And like, I do understand that frustration. Lila Corbin Berman said something to me when I interviewed her, because I was quite nervous. And I was like, you just know so much more about the subject than I do. And she said, you know, we all write in our own registers. And to me, that was really useful and very freeing. And I'm still today very appreciative to her for saying that, because I think it is true. Like, we all contribute to this conversation in our own way. And I hope that if people read my book and they're interested, I hope that they then read The American Jewish Philanthropic Complex. And I hope that they then read Rachel Cranston's Ambivalent Embrace. And I hope that they read Torn at the Roots and Black Power Jewish Politics and. I mean, I think this could not have been done without the work that people have already done. I hope that it's useful to other people who, and an introduction to people who maybe wouldn't pick up a Jewish studies book. It's also not claiming to be anything other than it is. Like, this is a work of journalism. It's history, but it's a work of history by a journalist. And I say that not to denigrate myself, but like, you know, if you're saying, oh, this isn't a work of scholarship. No, it's not. It's a work that draws on scholarship, and people should read the book with that in mind.
Thank you so much, Emily Tamkin, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. Before we fully close out and tell you all the ways you can be in touch with us, a reminder, Dan mentioned at the top, but I'm going to say it again. We have many, five to be exact, but many amazing mini courses that you can register for that begin in just a few weeks at the end of November and beginning of December. You can find out more about them, our On Yeshiva mini courses, by going to judaismunbound.com/classes. They're going to be amazing, and you should definitely check them out, whether you are a repeat On Yeshiva student or this will be your first time. If you have any questions for us or thoughts about those On Yeshiva courses or about this episode, you can be in touch with us in any of the following ways. There's our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram handles. All of those are at Judaism Unbound. There's our website, judaismunbound.com. And you can email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Or if it's related to the On Yeshiva, you can send us an email at onyeshiva@judaismunbound.com. That's onyeshiva@judaismunbound.com. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.